In a world full of enigmas, the thrill of seeking the truth, two men review the common and cryptic to contemplate the questions. Aiden Taratz and his father, Mateo Taratz. This is Big Little Mysteries. Episode 2, D.B. Cooper. Welcome to our second episode of Big Little Mysteries. Today is D.B. Cooper. This is one of those stories that's surpassed time. You know, it's lived in the lexicon for 50 years now, over 50 years. It happened in 71, I believe.
Yeah.
So it's one of those unsolved mysteries that may never be solved, because now we're kind of getting out of the point that all the people that could have been involved are dead. So yeah. It's very interesting. But let's start with introducing ourselves. This is Mateo Taratz.
And I'm his son, Aiden Taratz.
And we're going to talk to you about the story and see what kind of stuff we have on it. And if you got more stuff, let us know, because we'd love to hear from you. So why don't you go ahead, Aiden, with the synopsis of the D.B. Cooper story, the legend.
D.B. Cooper is an infamous figure in American criminal folklore. He was originally known for his hijacking of the Northwest Orient Airlines Flight 305 on November 24th, 1971. During the flight from Portland to Seattle, Cooper, who purchases his ticket under the alias Dan Cooper, revealed that he had what was thought to be a bomb to the crew and demanded a large amount of ransom, four parachutes, and a fuel truck standing by in Seattle to refuel the plane for a getaway.
Okay. So in this story, the crazy part and the part that makes it a mystery is that he got away with it. So basically this male, pretty generic, white, clean cut, looks like 30s, maybe 40s, with some have it with his sunglasses on, some don't, but suppose he went to the stewardess and kind of gave a little ransom note and said, hey, I'm going to take over this plane and I need money and I'm going to get away with it. As you said there's a lot of stuff involved. It wasn't just that he did this on a plane and jumped off. They had to land this plane.
Yeah.
They had to refuel the plane, get him the money, and then he had to take off again to do what he did.
And then he jumped out midair.
So what do you think about the story first? Like, I mean, it's obviously a story you've heard and that's why you want to talk about it, but what made you think about this mystery and want to talk about it?
So I used to see this on a lot of shows that, you know, that me and you watched when I was younger, like Unsolved Mysteries and mm-hmm. stuff. I always thought it was bizarre how someone could pull off something so big and still get away with it. He was never, you know, found, obviously.
That's true. And here's one of the things about this story. This is 1971. So we think planes, you get on a flight now, they gotta take your shoes off. They gotta look inside your ears, basically. They got that scanner that scans your body. Back then, you could just get on a plane. That's pretty much it. You had a ticket, you got on a plane. You could bring whatever you wanted at that point onto this plane, within reason. Like, if you had a bazooka, obviously, but I was reading stories about this because he is one of the first people to do this, but not the first to try this. But he is the only one in this, at least in this time period before they really started talking about it, that got away with it. Mm-hmm. Many people tried and almost got away with it. There's a couple people that, you know, there's plenty of people that almost got away with it, but nobody that actually got away with it as he has. And so that's already one of the crazy things that you think of, because you don't think of that today. I mean, that's back when they had this the ashtray and in the armrest of your chair and stuff like that. If you're next time you're on a plane, sometimes those planes, that's how you can tell how old the plane is, if it still has the ashtray in it. And I've been on a few of those, like, In 2010, I think I took a flight, or 2011, when we went down to Texas, one of the planes had a ashtrays in the seats, and that's wow, that's old. Obviously, there's no smoking on planes now, but there is drinking, and he did order a drink. That was one thing they noticed when he was on the plane. But yeah, it is definitely, he's actually become a like a legendary status, like a Billy the Kid type character almost, because of first of all, the I guess the good part is nobody was hurt in this. Like a lot of hijackings, it's almost like a kidnapping.
He's known as the Skyjacker because of
Yeah.
this.
Yeah. And there's a lot of
It's really the biggest aviation plot in history.
I mean, I guess of a person that got away with it and didn't hurt anyone, we'll say. Because there definitely, unfortunately, has been other aviation plots that have been worse and more infamous for worse reasons. Like this guy was just out for himself and not to injure anyone. He just wanted the money. Whereas a lot of people take planes and do bad things with them, or terrorist type actions. This was not that. So. As we talk about someone who's this infamous, it's good to like again think about the times, because they're actually he was not the first person to ever try this. The first person that is known to have ever tried this actually happened 11 days before this, on a Canadian flight. I think I wrote it down. Hold up, on a Canadian Air flight that was over Minnesota. The name was Paul Joseph Sinney. He was a Canadian who was taking this flight, and he tried to do this, but as he was getting his parachute on, he was taking a little bit of time, and the crew jumped him basically, and he had a shotgun, like he was ready to shoot people.
Ooh.
Do you have what DB Cooper, like how he basically delivered the ransom or anything like that, or?
No, I don't have anything on that.
Okay. I believe that he basically said like he could blow up the plane or something like this.
He subtly showed the flight attendant his bomb.
That's what it was. He said he had a bomb, which theoretically I guess would be a terrorist action at that point.
It was really just a briefcase with wires and red sticks. Nobody really knew if it was a
Yeah.
bomb or not.
But I mean, he threatened it. It's kind of like if you go into a bank and say, "I have a gun, give me money." You may not have a gun, but if somebody calls your bluff and they're wrong, they're getting injured. So that's why they kind of do what, and also that's also why if you go to a bank and do that, even if you don't have a gun, you can get charged with assault with a deadly weapon and other higher crimes because you said you had a gun, even if you didn't. And it's, also, some people kind of like will pretend to assume but not say to get a lower charge in bank robberies. That's a little insider baseball there, but they'll just like hand notes says, "I give me all the money and register," and now you're assuming that if this person has a gun, not just saying that, because theoretically it'd be like no, and then they just have to walk away if not, which does happen as well. I wouldn't call somebody's bluff on that, especially it's not my money, and. I guess that's kind of what with this plane, they were not going to call his bluff to see, if his suitcase bomb was not real. So, but yeah, this Paul Sinney, it's Cinni. He was the first person to try it. There was 15 others between 1971 and 1973 that tried this.
They thought they were going to do it again.
Most of them say they attempted it because they were inspired by the legend of D.B. Cooper. And it really is a legend, because there's another thing after the fall, they found partial stuff from this heist.
There was an 8-year-old boy who found $5,800 somewhere in the forest.
Yeah, it was at near, like, I believe it was near a river, in the Seattle area, if I remember correctly. And so they found some money. So was he Did he drop it by mistake? Like,
did he not survive the fall?
That's a big part of the legend. But all, obviously, no one found his body either. So, you know, that's a big part of legend. But also, just not, like, seeing some of the money there. Like, did the suitcase break?
Yeah.
Definitely, you're going terminal velocity. You could lose that suitcase. It's not strapped. It's not, like, handcuffed to you or anything like that. You could definitely, maybe the parachute didn't open correctly. Fell and hurt him, killed himself. We don't know. And that's what makes the legend such a legend, because they're like, he becomes an enigma in that way. He still survived in the lexicon, even if he didn't survive the fall. Mm. But also, why was there money not in the suitcase? That's a big, important piece of the puzzle that we'll never get. A cool thing about those, a thing that came out of those 15 people not succeeding was that eventually it was how the FAA regulated people getting on planes. It became a big part of the universal baggage check rule that was put forth in 1973, because people kept bringing guns on these planes. Like, all these people had machine guns or pistols or shotguns, and they would just bring them on the planes. And, like, maybe we should stop letting people bring guns on planes, you know? It was a pretty smart idea at that point, since somebody... I don't even know how you get a shotgun on a plane. That's, like, you gotta have a huge-ass bag first, so that's already rude. You got a giant bag.
Yeah.
You're not checking that bag. It has a shotgun in it. The one said an SMG, so it had a submachine gun in there. They had like an Uzi or something. I don't know, but I don't even know what a 1973 submachine gun is, but that's crazy stuff that people had in their bags. It also, there's two other things that came out of the in general, and one was named after D.B. Cooper. They started putting peepholes on cockpit doors so the pilot could see what was going on outside of the cockpit. I don't know if this is still a thing, probably electronically now, which is pretty interesting in itself. But this is, before that, the pilots just had to assume that everything was fine back there. And but also it made it so that it was harder for people to just break up in the cockpit and take over. And there's one other thing, because these doors kept getting pushed out and people were jumping out.
Mm-hmm.
But also, when you do that in the older planes, they didn't have the hub connection, like that connection that you dock with the airport. They had stairs. And so they made this little piece of metal that kept the cockpit stairs up while the plane was in flight, called the Cooper Vane. And it basically was so that you couldn't jump out that door easy. There's no way in flight that you could repel the stairs. Because if you repel the stairs and you're in flight, there's a good chance those stairs are going to get broken, ripped off. It's going to make it harder for the plane to land.
Yeah.
It might make it harder for the plane to fly, because it's off balance. So they made it was called the Cooper Vane, and it was V-A-N-E. Mm-hmm. And it was used to hold the plane or the stairs up. Those are just a couple of little interesting tidbits from this. So do we have, you said you have some suspects?
Yeah, I do have a list of suspects, okay. Actually.
And just so you guys know, we have a few of them. But they're...
There's hundreds.
Literally, the FBI at one point had over 1,000 serious candidates, suspects for D.B. Cooper. But they never really narrowed it down. They had a couple prime suspects, and I think that's who we're going to talk about here, but... they never really narrowed it down. So let's throw them out there, see what we got.
Over the years, there was, you know, like we just said, there was a lot of suspects. Among the most notable were Richard Floyd McCoy, who committed a similar airplane hijacking and parachute escape months after Cooper's heist. I think he was probably among that 15, right?
I think he was caught.
He was a Vietnam veteran and skilled parachutist, which added credibility to his theory. However, he was ruled out based on physical discrepancies and a solid alibi during Cooper's hijacking. Another suspect, who was named Dwayne Weber, claimed to be Cooper on his deathbed. which brought interest into his criminal background and knowledge of the Seattle area. His wife discovered a hidden stash of old airline tickets and a strange trip to the area where a portion of the ransom money was found, which is probably where that that 8-year-old boy was. There was also a man named Robert Rackstraw, love that last name, who was a former military pilot with parachute training. He became a suspect because of his background and hints that he made over the years, but nothing really linked him to the actual crime itself.
There's actually a documentary, a Netflix documentary, where they kind of follow, like they kind of follow him around and try to goad him into saying he did it. But he even says in different interviews, "I just said it to get attention, like years before that, and then I was a prime suspect." It's like, so then I just kind of rode with it, but I didn't do it. He's like, I wanted to. A lot of these people, unfortunately, kind of want to be a part of something. It's like that. I mean, who doesn't want to be like the Billy the Kid, you know, or the star of the show, really, when it comes to that stuff.
That's really about it for the main suspects, though.
Yeah, I mean, you really, there's plenty of people that,
like the most noticeable.
Well, the deathbed suspects. Confession thing was a lot of what got people intrigued, because like people would say, "Oh yeah, I guess just to get attention or like maybe give themselves an air of mystery as they were dying," but they would tell people that they were D.B. Cooper.
And fun fact. He wasn't actually called D.B. Cooper. It's just a misconception from the media. It's just Dan.
He called himself Dan Cooper, which I guess was the name of like an important person. I'm trying to think. Does it say it right there? No, it doesn't. Should have written that one down. Because there's a person, one of the suspects was named Lynn Doyle Cooper. And his niece began thinking that he was D.B. Cooper because he was planning something mischievous, and he was taking walkie-talkies, and he also it was a comic book hero, a Canadian comic book hero named Dan Cooper was where possibly the name Dan Cooper came from. Obviously, this guy did not use his real name, but I think Lynn Doyle Cooper, who went by LD as well, so that's maybe where they thought maybe DB would have been related to it. But it's funny because a lot of these people have these little pieces, but it almost becomes like the collective lexicon. It's almost like a King Arthur story of for our time. Because King Arthur famously is a story about this famous like English, British Isles, UK type king. Medieval times, there's a lot of these stories that are kind of over-exaggerated, like a tall tale. But a lot of the stories have a grain of truth in them. And that's because they were taken from different time periods, and different locations of kings and chieftains and stuff like that lived in that area, and kind of swooshed them into this one awesome hero. And so it's kind of what DB Cooper is like. All these people have something a little bit in common with DB Cooper, and they become part of the lexicon, part of the legend, because of that. Like this one guy's got the same last name, you know. Why would you use your last name? It's Dan, not Lynn.
It's DB, not LD.
And so it's just, it's really weird to think about people doing that stuff nowadays, but it's definitely something that could happen. I mean, still to this day. I was going to say, for the next 30 years, and I kind of mentioned this, it was one of the most popular thing, like deathbed confession type things for people to do, would say, "I'm D.B. Cooper," before they died.
Why do you think he did it?
That's a good question. I personally think someone like this would do this for the thrill of it. I mean,
That's one of the most famous theories.
Either live the hero or you die the villain, but, you know, if you make it somehow, then you have money and you have notoriety. A lot of people would I guess it's not really the easiest way to make money, but really hijacking a plane back then was easy-ish. And there was before the days of sky marshals. It was before the days, really, it was just people versus people at that point. So, and it didn't have as much of the stigma, I guess, in quotes, that it has now because of hijackings that have been deadly. There wasn't really that at that time. That wasn't a thing, you know. Then we had like Lockerbie, the Pan Am Flight 103. We had the World Trade Center 9/11 ones, and as that stuff became more brutal, and we wanted to make sure it didn't even get close to happening, it became a much more of a criminal, in quotes, terrorist thing than back then when it was like, oh, this guy just did something really cool almost. You know, because even at the time, even in 1971, like after a week, everybody's like, this guy got away with it? Wow. That's why you had all these copycats, because they were like, wow, this guy got away with it. That's why I think.
There's actually three big speculations as to why he did this. One of them was that. Another one was that he was driven by financial desperation. Some people think that he needed the ransom money to get rid of some personal or business debts.
Okay.
And
Well, I
then
guess he probably did it.
there's another speculation that how do I put this? He wanted to expose military and aviation expertise.
You want to like show the weakness of it, maybe? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, he wanted to be sh some people think that he wanted to be shown as a modern day Robin Hood.
And again, when it comes to speculation like that, we will never know. So, if, I don't know. It's almost like, okay, that's just you putting some hero stank on this guy. To me, he was just trying to make some money and have some fun. It's nice to say this guy was doing this to right the wrongs and rob from the rich and give to the poor and do good stuff. But at the end of the day, he wasn't really the one who enacted that change. Except for that thing that holds the cockpit door up, I guess, because they named it after him. But there was, again, 14, 15 other people that did this after him as well in the next 2 years. And that, they're like, well, okay, guys, enough's enough. Somebody brings a submachine gun or a shotgun onto a plane, we need to figure out how to not
We
make
don't
money.
want your Z70s on here, okay?
Yeah, like it's crazy to think that somebody's like got a shotgun in their bag and was doo 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 walking through. There's no scanners back then. There's none. You just walked in to an airport. It's really weird to think about, because even as a kid for me in the 80s, there were scanners at least of some sort. They're X-ray scanners. Like we've always grown up with that kind of technology, whereas you walk right in. You walk right in, you get in line, you get on the plane. So it's pretty weird and wild to think about. So do we have any far-fetched theories on this?
I mean, besides for
Like
what
is it
happened after.
aliens? Was it an alien?
Was it alien?
Yeah, nobody asked that. I mean, he looked humanoid, right? But he got away with it. Maybe he got beamed up.
I don't know. He was a little freaky looking.
He did look very white guy generic to me. Like, I don't know.
His face was like weirdly shaped.
Well, and there's two different composite drawings, actually. There's one from 71 and one from 72, and I think they are pretty different. Let me see if I can bring it up for you. The first one was the original one was this one right here.
The original one
He kind of looks like Agent Coulson. He looks like Clark Gregg
He
from
does. It's
and
weird.
the second one, he's got more of like they
Oh,
really differently shaped his face. They gave him more of a chin.
yeah, those are two different
Yeah, they're
faces.
very different faces. They're very different hairlines. Although in this one, they kind of like fudged they like moved the gap. This is basically this one they updated a little bit. But at the same time, they didn't know what he looked like really. Like they didn't, because they the first year in November It was almost a year before they had the second sketch.
And I don't really think that the 36 passengers that he let off took a good look at his face either.
Well, I don't know if they were completely aware of it, because that's the kind of the way they made it. He did it so quietly that they just got off the plane. And when especially when you don't have a weapon of any sort, like per se, when you have a bomb, people are more scared that you let up that switch and you're going to, you know, you're going to blow everyone up. Whereas with a gun, there's a chance of us stopping your gun from shooting someone.
Mm-hmm.
So bombs, unfortunately, was kind of the ultimate weapon to get things done quietly and quickly when it came to getting this money. It's, I mean, what a crazy day these flight attendants and the FAA must have had.
I feel bad for anyone that was on flight 305 on November 24th, 1971.
I said some of them might not even know they had anything going on, though. They probably go off the flight and go, oh, I didn't even know. And maybe someone did see him differently, and that's why the sketch got changed, too.
They also know that he had a very good understanding of the layout of a Boeing 727,
mm-hmm.
which I found a little interesting because he knew his way around. Like, was he planning to get on this exact flight? Or,
I mean, 727s were the big plane of the time where I don't even think DC-10s were around yet, I'm trying to think. 727s were kind of like the monopoly of the plane at the time. So maybe he knew, maybe he knew all the planes, or maybe he just was really lucky that he got this plane, or a little bit lucky, you know, because like I said, 727s were pretty standard for the time. But it's still an interesting thing. But why don't we think that, you know, how could this guy get away with this?
That's a good question.
It's one to think about, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and here's the thing, too. There's no DNA at the time, per se. He did leave his tie behind.
He left a tie clip. Like
a clip-on tie. Yeah. And there actually was a partial DNA on it, but there's no way to know if that was his or somebody else's.
I remember seeing something back in January. It was like there was new evidence found in the case. It was that clip-on tie.
Yeah. Well, and they've had the clip-on tie for a bit, but they took a DNA profile off it. But they've all these suspects that they really had that they could get DNA from, they already have, and they haven't matched it. So even like the Robert Rackstraw guy, they took his DNA and didn't match. But they don't know even if this is, it could just be someone else has touched it.
Yeah.
DNA, because it wasn't like today where we preserve that, we put it in a bag. It's probably handled by like 20 people, you know. So somebody probably put it on and was like, look, I'm Timmy Cooper. You know, so we don't know. It's just kind of like another piece of hay in the haystack, you know, or the needle in the haystack we're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the most intriguing and mysterious part about this is that money. The money was found in 1980, by the way, so it was found 7 years after it happened. It was probably a coldish day. It was November 24th, so it was like getting close to winter, blustery in the mid-northwest. It was probably like cold-ish. And so did he maybe land in the water and, you know, get hypothermia? Why would that money be there? And especially not that much of the money, but enough where you wouldn't really leave that behind. That's always been very curious to me. Like, did he land in there and he landed right next to a bear or something? Like, what happened that...
How did he... If he survived, how did he get back to society? That's another question.
Well, I mean, theoretically, especially if he seemed to have some kind of survivalist skills, at least he seemed to have the brass balls to deal with it. But you can get out of the woods, you know, you can follow river till rivers kind of lead you towards civilization at some point. We don't know what provisions, if any, he had on him. He was wearing a suit, and he had that suitcase. So we don't know if he had like snacks on him or a compass or anything like that. I know that he talked a lot with the flight attendants, but he didn't really mention like how he was getting it done. Here we go. I really kind of, I was going to say the three fun facts or facts we didn't know. I kind of sprinkled them in. It's like I said, we were talking about how the 15 people had done this over the years. But this also, D.B. Cooper's story has inspired dozens of movies and TV shows to do something similar. The most recent one I can remember is in one of the episodes of the Disney Plus show Loki. He was D.B. Cooper in this episode. Like when he was traveling, he was kind of traveling through time, and he was D.B. Cooper in the episode. He's wearing the black suit and stuff. And so Tom Hiddleston, who plays Loki, was D.B. Cooper in the episode.
That's
But
funny.
there's a lot of stuff that's been stories that have been inspired by. I think I might have written this part down actually. Shows like Prison Break, The Blacklist, Leverage, all these newer shows even are still inspired by this legendary story, which kind of makes it live on forever. That's what really makes it this big legendary mystery. Do you have anything else that you want to add to this?
I don't really think I have anything else.
Yeah, this one is one of those ones that will always be a mystery. I don't think there's any way we're cracking it today, especially with all those people that are involved, because there are a lot of people that had, like I said, if you think about like the top five things that DB Cooper that would have said this guy's DB Cooper, a lot of people are like three out of five of those that they've picked off. And that's maybe why he's had so many suspects, because he's just a generic white guy in the end. Like he's pretty much as boring looking as you could think of. He wasn't like overly muscular or, had a mohawk or anything like that. They wouldn't have in 1971, nobody would have had a mohawk, but he was like a regular dude. And so it's hard to say, especially now that time has moved on without a resolution. It's hard to say it'll ever be resolved, just because we don't even have these people around to question them at this point. Like even Robert Rackshaw died in 2019. All these people have died between 2000 and a couple years ago.
Yeah.
So I think every suspect I saw on there was passed away already, of all the main suspects. So really, it's tough to question them, and all you'll get now is a story from their family.
And what's even worse is that DB Cooper could possibly be dead too.
That's what I'm saying, though. All these people that would be DB could be DB Cooper have already passed away. So
We're never gonna
whether
know.
we're never really gonna know. That's I think too, because like I said, now we're gonna get the stories. Well, my uncle told me he was DB Cooper in 2011 or something. Okay, is your uncle alive? No. Okay, then there's no way to prove it. And a lot of deathbed confessions, which the whole point of a deathbed confession is you're saying it before you die. There's no follow-up questions to that. So it's gonna end up being a mystery. All right, well, that's all we have for DB Cooper, guys. Let us know if you got any other conspiracy theories. We didn't really conspiracy theory this one too much, but it's still in itself, it's every suspect is kind of a conspiracy theory. So that was the cool thing about it. But let us know what you think. And yeah, that's all we have for our show today. Do we have next week's or next time's yet?
Yeah. Join us next week for the Bell Witch Haunting.
Ooh, Bell Witch Haunting. That sounds delightful. Guys, keep following the mysteries, okay?